Welcome to the next episode of the Subluxation Science Summit. This is your host, Dr. Daniel Knowles, and I'm grateful to be putting on this Mile High event so people in the field and students can have the real deal on how important and central subluxation is and the adjustment is to the practice of chiropractic. And the science and research that is available to them and existing, and will continue to build on. This episode, I am honored to be able to interview Dr. Christopher Kent. He is well known within the profession, almost needs no introduction. Currently faculty at Sherman College, the founder of On Purpose, and so many other accolades in chiropractic. I am welcoming you to the Mile High Subluxation Summit.
Well, thank you, Danny. It's really a privilege and an honor to be here. Happy to be asked, and we've got a lot of great stuff for everyone. There's so much going on in the world of research. As you know, we review it monthly on Purpose. I'm also involved in the Foundation for Vertebral Subluxation. We have a number of projects that are ongoing. We currently have a diagnostic imaging initiative, and I have a paper in preparation regarding prevalence of MRI findings and so forth. So a lot of fun stuff going on.
Yes, and we're grateful for all your contributions to chiropractic over your career and continuing with those. And with the Mile High Subluxation Summit, we want to emphasize the Foundation for Vertebral Subluxation and being a supporter of that, of the schools and institutions that also highlight subluxation, the nonprofits such as the IFCO and the Epigenetics Foundation, and we could go on and on. And right now, what I would like to do is really bring people's attention to how important subluxation is to be central to the practice of chiropractic, and this thing of making it a historical fact or something that needs to be wiped from education, and how ridiculous that is, and how important it is that that be uplifted in chiropractic, that being the subluxation adjustment. So let's have you move forward with what information you have to share to help people have more certainty, feel like they're on solid ground with that, and how important subluxation science and research and validity is.
Terrific. Well, let's get started. I wanted to kind of put things in context before we get into the nitty-gritty of the program, because I always have kind of the large world view of what this is about. And I get into chiropractic because of my interest in empowering people to express their potential and to realize their dreams. And after investigating many career options, I concluded that there's nothing that one human being can do for another that has as much potential to improve their quality of life on as many levels as quickly, simply, and safely as chiropractic care. So let's look at how this fits into context. Here in the United States, we spend $3.5 trillion per year on so-called healthcare. That's 17.9% of our gross domestic product. That's about twice as much as the next developed nation on the list. And just to make that real for you, if you were able to count to $1 trillion, it would take you 300 centuries to do so, just to count. So that's how real that number is, just trying to set it in context. And we have to ask ourselves, we're spending all this money, what are we getting for it? And the answer is a rather disappointing return on our investment. Medical errors and iatrogenic events are a leading cause of death in the U.S. Number one, number two, or number three, depending on who you read. A paper last year in BMJ said number two. And the U.S. ranks 37th in overall healthcare performance, according to the World Health Organization. And again, this isn't bashing medicine. It's just making you aware of the state of the art. Because if we go back to 1991, in the BMJ, David Eddy, who was kind of a key figure in the evidence-based medicine movement. He said only about 15% of medical interventions are supported by scientific evidence. This is partly because only 1% of the articles in medical journals are scientifically sound. People say, well, that's 1991. Well, if we fast forward to 2017, there was a study published looking at the strength of the evidence supporting the top interventions used in primary care. And here they came up with 18%. So it's grown a little bit. And again, I point this out because when we look at the safety profile of chiropractic, when we look at the evidence that we do have to support what we do, we have nothing to be ashamed about. This is the de facto state of the art. Indeed, here's where the opportunity lies. Kilo and Larson published a paper in JAMA where they basically questioned, if you look at the first paragraph, that the data remain imprecise, but they're not sure that the benefits that U.S. healthcare delivers outweighs the aggregate harm it imparts. They're not even sure they're breaking even. But here's the juice. This is what's inspiring to me. They acknowledge that healthcare contributes only 10% toward reducing premature death.
Wow.
Even a perfectly designed delivery system would prevent only a modest proportion of premature death. The other 90% is attributable to something other than the disease care system.
Wow.
And part of that 90%, a big part of it, is living a life free from nerve interference. So a couple neat things. I'm just going to go through these references quickly for you. I received an invitation to present at the European Neurology Conference in Venice, which was kind of cool. And what were they interested in? Vertebral subluxation. Yes, that's the topic. And I'm going to do it by video because I don't do much flying anymore. Here's a paper that we'll be referring to, published in Archives in Neurology and Neuroscience just this year on the various neurobiological models associated with vertebral subluxation. And there's a link to it. You can get a full text copy free. And I understand you'll be making the PowerPoint available. So don't worry about trying to write things down. You won't be able to. This is going fast. Also did a paper on chiropractic and mental health with a history of chiropractic's involvement in there and a review of neurobiological mechanisms. There's the link to that. Again, full text is free. And I also found this paper, which is interesting. Spinal cord is smarter than previously thought. I went to the original, and with all this discussion of the importance of the brain, and I'm certainly not disparaging that work, it's important to realize that the spinal cord is able to process and control some very complex functions. We normally think of, you know, you touch a hot stove, your finger pulls away, that's a spinal cord reflex. Now they're finding that such sophisticated neuromotor activity as hand positioning can occur just at the spine. And I know you're intimately familiar with the work that Jean Kerr did with quadriplegics and EMG activity and so forth. So there's a lot going on in the spinal cord. We know it can learn and remember behavior, and that plasticity is not confined to the brain. So I like to think of the nervous system as a whole rather than breaking it up. And we might be touching on heart rate variability as a means of assessing the autonomic system. Here's a paper in that. That also is available full text free for you. So let's talk about vertebral subluxation and why it's so important. There is, as you pointed out, a phenomenon called semantic pathology, as well as epistemic trespassing and some ethical problems. And what it boils down to is that there are people suggesting that the vertebral subluxation doesn't exist, or at best is just an obsolete historical concept. There are also individuals conflating the terms vertebral subluxation and joint dysfunction, manipulable lesions, stuff like that. And it's important to realize that they're not talking about the same thing. Stevenson's definition is something most of us are familiar with, where a vertebra has lost its proper juxtaposition with the one above, the one below, or both, to an extent less than a luxation, which impinges nerves and interferes with the transmission of mental impulses. And what it boils down to is that our clinical objective is the analysis and correction of vertebral subluxation for the fullest quality and expression of life. And what we find is that despite what definition people use, there are two components. There's a mechanical component and a neurological component. So vertebral subluxation is simply not the same as joint dysfunction.
That looks like
yes,
a mile
I see
high
that
picture.
Tongue in cheek, knowing that this is mile high we're speaking with. And they are epistemically as well as operationally very different. And conflating those terms is very dangerous. So let's talk about physical mechanisms involved in biological communications. If we go back to physics and chemistry, this is a scheme that was developed by an author in an osteopathic textbook from decades ago, and it still is valid today. The first is diffusion of particles along concentration gradients, osmosis, diffusion, membrane stuff. The second, diffusion of quanta along electromagnetic gradients, EEG, EMG, ECG, as well as ephaptic transmission, which is electrical field effects that are non-synaptic in nature. Transmission of substances within structured channels. We're seeing more and more work on this. Blood, lymph, cerebrospinal fluid, and on a cellular level, exoplasm, and how all of these are related to vertebral subluxation. And then finally, wave propagation, not just your classic compression or refraction type wave that might be associated with hearing and vibration sense, but things like soliton wave transmission, some really heady stuff. So I find it interesting that when they came up with these back in the 60s, the list is still good today. So let's go back even further to Stevenson's textbook, where he said, we might conceive of the mental impulses being such forces in the tissue cell as electricity, valency, magnetism, cohesion, etc. Perhaps some of these energies are not known to us in physics. What right have we to assume that we found them all? But we do have some neurobiological mechanisms that we have a pretty good understanding of, and that understanding is continuing to grow. Mechanical effects like cord compression and adverse cord tension, nerve root compression, local irritation, vertebral artery compromise, autonomic dysfunction, coherence and oscillatory patterns, and disafferentation and neural plasticity. And what I'd like to point out here, and this is something I'm very passionate about, one mechanism does not preclude the other, and there may be multiple mechanisms operating in a given individual at a given time. And there's a trend in some research circles to say, well, you know, cord compression, root compression, hard bone, soft nerve, this is obsolete. We're going to see that's not so at all. This phenomenon may also be associated with local irritation, vertebral artery compromise, and some of these other phenomena. So let's look at the mechanical factors of compression and stretch. Back in 1974, Seth Sharpless of the University of Colorado did an animal study, actually a series of animal studies, where he measured how much pressure it took to produce a significant conduction block in the nerve. And studies of peripheral nerves suggest it took a lot of pressure, somewhere between 100 and 1,000 millimeters of mercury pressure. To make that real for you, imagine a blood pressure cuff pumped up to, say, 100 or 200. Obviously, those types of pressures, they said, probably don't occur at the IVF. But he said perhaps the nerve roots themselves are more sensitive. And he found that a pressure of only about 10 millimeters of mercury, about the weight of a dime or the threshold of perception of your finger on the back of your hand, was necessary to produce a significant block. And what he did was he stimulated a nerve, he recorded the output, and he applied pressure with a little balloon, which, trivia, was a prophylactic condom. He found they worked best for applying small amounts of pressure. And lo and behold, he came up with that number of 10 millimeters. what I found interesting is that over 20 years later, Kano's group published a paper in Spine where they came up with exactly the same number, even though they hadn't cited sharpless. And that is compression with as little as 10 millimeters of mercury resulted in decreased action potentials. And I found this very interesting. In this paper, they pointed that when we have compression, dysfunction is not confined to degeneration at the site of compression, but extends to the primary sensory neurons within the dorsal root ganglion. So we see that there's more involved than just pain of dermatomal distribution. There's another effect that's often overlooked involved in compression of nerve. Rydovic discussed this in a paper, and that is venous blood flow. If the venous blood flow is compromised, we'll see swelling of nerve as well as a compromise of the nutrient flow to spinal nerves. And he found that that occurred at even lower pressures, 5 to 10 millimeters of mercury pressure. So the more we learn, the more we see that's going on here. And I've had people say, well, you know, those are animal studies. We need to eliminate this squashed nerve model and so forth. What about human studies? And I used to say, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, well, it's hard to find people willing to let you cut them open and see what happens. Well, 114 people who were getting cut open anyway said, go for it. And in this paper, they looked at intraforaminal and extraforaminal entrapment of the L5 nerve root in 114 people that were undergoing spine surgery. And they found that what they called the SNAPs, the sensory nerve action potentials, decreased in amplitude when the lesion was at or distal to the dorsal root ganglion, and that the amplitude was decreased when you have foraminal stenosis. House also wrote a paper quite a while ago talking about how nerve root compression can exist without pain. It can be asymptomatic, and that mechanical changes lead to circulatory changes, as we discussed. We also have a chemical component. When there's local irritation of the motion segment, we see things like substance P and histamine causing the nerves to become inflamed. So we have these inflammatogenic agents which can cause disruption and symptomatically a chemical radiculitis. We know that there may be disturbances in CSF flow. We have the work of Scott Rosa and Raymond Demedian, who, by the way, invented MRI, looking at changes that occur in the flow of cerebrospinal fluid before and after upper cervical adjusting. House also pointed out that there may be sensitization of the sympathetic system, and this whole phenomenon can create a vicious self-perpetuating cycle. Another mechanical thing is stretch. Wall's group reported that at only 6% strain, the amplitude of the action potential had decreased by 70% after an hour. And this is very significant because we know from the work of Alf Brieg and more recently some of the work of the CBP group that when there are alterations in spinal curves, there's adverse tension applied to the cord as well as the nerve roots. And these have physiological consequences. We've known this for decades. We also have been observing some really interesting stuff regarding blood flow to the brain associated with alterations of curves. A paper was recently published on that. So let's take a look at some consequences that occur as a result of compressive pathology. These are dorsal root ganglion cells from an experimental animal. I just want you to kind of do the 30,000 foot view, look at the cytoplasm and look at the nucleus. Well, they artificially induced what they called a spinal strain, which could be done either traumatically or by the injection of an irritant solution of saline in the paraspinal muscles. And in these animals, they found that when this occurred, the cell started to undergo chromatolysis or destruction of color. And if this process was continued, lo and behold, we actually have death of the cell occurring. And you can see as we went from slide 1 to slide 2 to slide 3, and you can do this yourself when you get the PowerPoint, there's what they called a chromophobic response. It wasn't absorbing as much dye. Even more interesting is what happens in target tissues. These were the same group of animals. This is an example of liver tissue where they had induced one of these thoracic strains. And this is the normal appearance. By the arrow, you can see that there's these wide white areas, which are called sinusoids, where the fluid pools. Well, lo and behold, after the spinal strain, we start to see cloudy swelling. Those sinusoids are obliterated. So we can see that the early stages of pathology are manifesting rather early in the game. A second model, which is very significant, is disafferentation. And to my knowledge, I'm the first one to use it in a peer-reviewed paper. And I didn't really think it was that big a deal. I didn't think it was really a significant novel term because the concept had been described back in the 1960s by the authors of the book Segmental Neuropathy. And they came up with a really elegant concept. They said that the body creates a neural image based on its perception of the internal and external environment. So the body's perception of itself and the environment forms this neural image. And again, as they used to say in the IT world, garbage in, garbage out. If the body is not producing competent afferent input into the brain, if the afferent leg of the safety pin cycle is compromised, it's going to be very difficult to make qualitative and quantitatively appropriate responses to changes in environmental dynamics. And this is a book, or a picture from the book, Segmental Neuropathy, looking at what they call local sensorial conversational tone. What a cool word.
Wow.
Yeah. So conversational tone, the dance, the communication that occurs between the brain cell and the tissue cell when everything is working as it should. Founded on tone, that's the subtitle of D.D. Palmer's book, where he talked about the normal degree of nerve tension. And that relates to both mechanical tension and neurophysiologic function. And take a look at the complex innervation of the motion segment, the disc, the ligaments, the muscles, the posterior joints, which have very complex innervation with a variety of mechanoreceptors, slow adapting, rapidly adapting, and so forth. The CSF, information from the viscera, baroreceptors, cutaneous information, all of this stuff goes into the dorsal root ganglion and gives the brain information about what's going on. And you have to ask, why did the intelligence of the body create all of this sensory apparatus if it isn't really important to have information concerning the position and motion of a vertebra as it relates to every other system in the body? And here we can see the innervation of the disc. And I like to mention this because when I was a student, we were told that the disc didn't have a nerve supply, that pain originated either from the muscles or the periosteum. And I won't go through all of these, but because they didn't use appropriate stains to disclose the presence of neural elements, you know, they don't show up with standard microbiologic dyes like methylene blue and stuff. You need gold stains, or you can do immunohistochemical tests to look for an antibody response that is indicative of the presence of neural tissue. So all of this stuff disclosed the existence of this stuff. And here we have a slide showing you vascular elements. If we look at the vertebral end plates, you can see, this is kind of interesting, this is the Spalteholt's process, which is used and making the wet specimen of BJ, if you remember that, you know, that translucent bone specimen.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, here it was done with vertebra, and they injected the vessels with dye and then applied the Spalteholt's process to make them translucent. And the reason I like to show this is because when you see end plate sclerosis on a radiograph, that's serious. That's interfering with the nutrition to the disc, along with all the other stuff that's going on that we just talked about. We know that the supraspinal and interspinal ligaments have a nerve supply. We know that the meningeal fibers have a nerve supply. We know that degenerative changes are associated with mechanical compromise of the cord and the nerves. We can look at MRI studies and see alterations due to degenerative change far earlier than we can see them on plain films. If you remember from your radiology studies, it takes about a 30 to 50% change in bone density before you can see anything. On MRI, we can see changes in hydration about 3% or so. So when I was doing my MRI training, I came across this booklet by three radiologists that really blew my mind. Magnetic resonance imaging of the lumbar spine, nerve root canals, disc abnormalities, anatomic correlations, and case examples. And if we look at the environment of the normal IVF, which you can see here, you can see the nerve root kind of abutting the yellow ligament, the ligamentum flavum there. Unfortunately, I don't have a pointer to point. And those dark areas represent vessels. And around the periphery, you can see that there's other tissue that's fat. Because these things are so exquisitely sensitive to compression block and to circulatory compromise, the intelligence of the body's created a fatty insulator to protect them. Pretty bright. Well, with degenerative disease, look what's going on. That ligamentum flavum, that big yellow thing you see kind of at the top right of your screen, has become corrugated, it's become hypertrophied, it's causing stenosis. You can see how the red hemopoietic marrow is being replaced by yellow fatty marrow, which will eventually develop into an osteophyte, and how that's entrapping the nerve root. Real quick on MRI, just so you can understand these images, what we're looking at with MRI images basically is how much hydrogen is in the tissue. And where do we have hydrogen? Where we have fat and where we have water. So we can set the machine to either make fat look white or make water look white. And the easy way to remember this is T2, H2O, water, voila. So let's look at this. The image on the left is a T1 weighted image. You can see that the vertebral bodies are pretty bright because of the marrow fat, except at the arrows. What's that dark area? Notice that the L4, L5 disc space looks pretty good. So this was an individual who came to a chiropractor complaining of pain that was not of dermatomal distribution. Plain radiographs were taken and they were written off as a malingerer, because they said, the pain's not of dermatomal distribution. The x-ray looks fine. There's just a little L5, S1 disc thinning, no big deal. But if we do an MRI, we see a lot more. The center image shows that where that dark stuff appeared on the T1 weighted image, white material or high signal intensity areas can be seen at the arrow. That's due to edema associated with an inflammatory process. And if we look at that L4, L5 disc, we see that it's desiccated, it's drying out, not a happy state of affairs. And although this cadaveric specimen isn't the same one, you know, hard to find patients willing to submit to that, I matched one as best I could. And as you can see, there's degeneration at L5, S1, far more robust than at L4, L5. And I remember, for those of you who don't know, I'm an attorney as well, and I was involved in a case where an adverse witness was suggesting that the disc degeneration that we see is normal aging. I said, well, doctor, I just have one question for you. How much older is this disc than that disc? And when I asked my chief when I was doing the MRI visiting fellowship what he thought about normal aging, he said, well, of course not. He said, if it were, it would be homogeneous throughout the spine, or at least the region, but it's not. It's associated with pathomechanics and occurs at different level in different people.
Right.
And I thought, yeah. So this degenerative cascade involves pathomechanics leading to ligamentous tugging, leading to focal inflammation, yellow marrow formation, and osteophyte formation. And this is from that book I showed you. Remember when we had those charts, phases of spinal degeneration, and people said science? Well, this is out of that booklet by the three radiologists. Grade one, take a look at the posterior joints, take a look at the nerve root, and where the arrow is, that's the nerve root. The white stuff around it is fat. Grade two, they call this slight. Look at how there's a misalignment at the posterior joints. that is starting to cause occlusion of an opening and impingement of a nerve. Grade 3, they called this mild. Now we're actually starting to see facet arthrosis in the posterior joints as well as end plate sclerosis. Grade 4, moderate. And what's going on? Look at the top. What happens when you compress? It interferes with the venous drainage. And what happens if you interfere with the venous drainage, save the leg, you know, it swells. That's what's happening here.
Right.
We can see that on MRI. And severe, you know, where the intelligence in the body has said enough is enough and just shuts down the motion completely. So here's another case of an individual who was thought to be a malingerer and had normal plane films. If you look at L4, L5, you can see the anterior disc displacement. And if we look at the T2 weighted images, surprise, surprise, notice how the healthy discs are very bright. The degenerated disc is darker anteriorly, and we have end plates that are lit up as well as part of probably the marrow. Again, edema possibly due to an inflammatory process. Here in the C-spine, we can see some very mild posterior degeneration at 4-5. Not much. If we take an axial image, we can see the spinal cord, the CSF. We can actually see the anterior and posterior nerves. You know, you can see the posterior or the dorsal root ganglion. You can see the ventral and dorsal roots. Pretty cool.
Yeah. Wow.
And you can also see very well the sharp demarcation between the layers of muscles of the spine. Well, in this individual, notice we have uplifting of the posterior longitudinal ligament, and we have material causing impression on the thecal sac and actually the cord itself. And if we look at an axial image there, you can see the disc herniation. You can see on one side, on the reading right side, there's this dark thing emerging from the encinet process, which is causing foraminal stenosis there. And notice that our ability to discriminate between the layers in the back muscles is not so wonderful either.
Wow.
And if we take a plain film, loss of the curve, little bit of degeneration, again, was told by a physician that everything was groovy. But if one did something as simple as draw lines along the inferior aspect of each vertebral body, you can see how on the left, they converge as they should. In this patient, we actually had divergence at the involved level, as well as evidence aberrant biomechanics at C1, C2. And if we look at a cadaver, the cervical spine, again, you can see replacement of red marrow with yellow fatty material as biomechanical dysfunction is working its magic. If we look at the corresponding T2 weighted image on this person's C-spine, we can again see degeneration of the involved disc, dark stuff posteriorly. We can see a very robust increase in signal intensity in the posterior aspect of the two involved bodies. Kind of again, that wedge-shaped look suggesting inflammatory activity. So what happens there? Again, histamine, substance P. Is there a reason why this person has pain not of dermatomal distribution? Yes. Hardly a malingerer.
Right.
Goodness, we're almost out of time. Let me share this with you, and then we'll press on. This is an MRI animation of the C-spine, and this is a pretty good one. Looks pretty healthy. On the other hand, if the person has a subluxation causing degenerative change, you can see that as they flex and extend, it's actually causing impression on the cord. It's kind of like hammering on that cord as they flex and extend. And if you look closely in the upper cervical spine, you can see that the craniocervical junction is not doing what it should either. Again, a relatively normal one. When that happens, the body's not getting good information about the actual kinematics of the intervertebral motion segment and its environs, and that can cause disruption on many levels. So I see we're out of time. You know, time flies when you're having fun. We'll leave it at that. Two thoughts. The decisions you make and the actions you take today sculpt your future and that of humanity. We know that epigenetics, or changes that occur in the expression of your genome, are related to your lifestyle choices, one of which is the decision to live life free from vertebral subluxation. So don't let the deniers get you down. As Will Rogers said, even if you're on the right track, you'll get run over if you just sit there. So don't just sit there.
Wow.
Realize the sacred trust does lie in your hands, and that you're the ones that turn all these ideas into life-changing moments for your practice members.
Wow. Thank you so much. And I have to say that, one, thank you for all you're doing at Sherman College for evidence-informed studies. And this is about informing our audience of the evidence that is there. And obviously, this is just a perusal of a surface level. There's so much more. I would highly encourage people, first and foremost, if you are not already a supporter, support the Foundation for Vertebral Subluxation. That is an impetus of this summit, is for people to support. And then you can also support financially and also by contributing research. Be a member on purpose so you can learn and have information that creates certainty. I so find so often people are uncertain as practitioners of what it is they're sharing with their patients and practice members, and this helps them. And the other way is if you are a member of the Foundation for Vertebral Subluxation, rather a supporter, then up your level of support. We need this in our profession, and support the institution and foundations that are, such as the Epigenetics Foundation and CVP nonprofit and Sherman College, and the institutions that are furthering this aspect of chiropractic and chiropractic having subluxation, the adjustment as the center point of everything we do as chiropractors. I cannot thank you so much for all that you've contributed to chiropractic through your career, Dr. Ken. Is there anything else that you want to share as a last word to audience relative to science and research and chiropractic subluxation?
I'll close with what I started with, and that is that there's no one thing that I'm aware of that an individual human being can do for another that improves the quality of their life on as many levels as quickly, safely, and effectively as the skillful correction of vertebral subluxation.
Thank you. And thank you so much for being enjoying this segment of the Mile High Subluxation Science Summit with Dr. Christopher Kent. Stay tuned for the next segment.
And thank you for the opportunity to be a part of it.